Chapter 8. Lysander the Gulf. The baking sand warms my feet. They're smaller than I remember, paler, and the gulls that careen overhead much larger, much fiercer as they spin and dive into the water of a sea so blue I cannot tell where ocean ends and sky begins. Gentle waves call to me. I've been here before, but I cannot remember when or how I came to be on this beach. A man and woman are in the distance, their feet leaving slender paths that the waves in time slowly devour step by step, then all at once till they are gone, as if they were never there. I call to them. They begin to turn, but I do not see their faces. I never do. Something is behind me, casting a shadow over them, over the sand, darkening the beach and the sea as the wind builds to a feral howl. My body jerks awake. I'm alone. Far from the beach, drenched in sweat upon my sleeping pallet. A ventilator whirs rhythmically in the dimness of my room, and I shudder a breath. The fear fades. It was just a dream. Above me on the bulkhead, the words of my fallen house glare down at me, etched into the metal. Lux ex tenebris, light from darkness. And spinning outward from those words like the spokes of a wheel are the idealist poems of youth, the wrathful, slashing script of adolescence, when I was all blood and fury and ruled by wilder passions. Then, finally, the first fledgling steps of wisdom, as I began to realize how terrifyingly small I really am. My father never seemed small. I remember him and his immense calm, the smile lines around his eyes, his unruly hair, his slender hands, how they sat folded in his lap when he listened. There was a vast, settled peace inside him, a tranquillity given to him by his father, Lornau Arcus, who stretched duty and honour under the banner of the Griffin. Lost things to this world, though some were out there, the grim still flies. My memory is a formidable thing. In many ways, it is my grandmother's great legacy, her teachings preserved in me. Despite that, my mother's face is a nightshade in my mind, always roving in the chasms, slipping beyond my grasp. I've heard she was wild, a woman of vast ambition, but history is so often moulded from tainted clay by those who remain. I know more of her from my grandmother's mouth than from my own memory. Such was my grandmother's grief after her passing that no servant was permitted to speak her name aloud. Who was she? The few pictures I've found on the hollow net are all obscured, taken from a distance, as if she were a figment even cameras could not capture. Now time erodes her face in my mind like waves did the footprints in the sand. I was young when my parents' starship went down over the sea. They say it was terrorists, outriders from the rim. Only when I read the few poems my mother left behind in her notebooks do I feel her heart beat against my spine, her arms wrapped around my shoulders, her breath in my hair. I sense that strange magic of her that my father so loved. The night terrors again? The voice of my teacher startles me. He stands looking into my room, golden eyes, dark pools in the starship's night cycle lighting. His powerful shoulders fill the doorway and he bends at the neck, wary of the low doorframe. The engines hum soothingly beyond my small metal room. The place had space enough when I was a boy, but 20 now, I feel like a potted plant spilling root and limb from a cracking clay bowl. Books fill the spaces between my bunk, tiny closet and lavatory. Salvaged, stolen, purchased and found over the last 10 years. My new prize, a third edition of the Aeronaut, sits by my bedside. Just a dream, I say, wary of showing vulnerability in his eyes because I know how young the Martian still thinks I am. I swing my slender legs from the bed and bind my mess of hair behind my head with a band. Have we arrived? Just? Verdict? My good man, do I look like your valet? No, she was much fairer, with better bedside manner. Adorable, pretending you just had one. I raise an eyebrow. You should talk, Prince of Mars. Cassius Albellona grunts. So are you going to sleep the day away, or get up and see for yourself? He nods for me to follow. I do, as I have for 10 years. I smell whiskey in his wake. Once the world's called Cassius the Morning Knight, protector of the society, slayer of Ares. Then he murdered his sovereign, my grandmother, and let the rising tear down the very society he swore to protect. He let Darrow destroy my world and bring chaos to the society. I can never forgive him for that, but neither can I repay the debt I owe him. He kept Severo Albarca from killing me, He pulled me from the ashes of Luna and the chaos that followed, and for 10 years he has protected me, given me a home, a second family. We could be mistaken for brothers, and often are. Our hair has that same lustre of gold, though his is curled and mine straight. My eyes are pale as yellow crystal, his are dark gold. He's half a head taller than I, and broader in the shoulders, and manly in the features. A thick, pointed beard, a prominent, bold nose, where my face is thin and patrician, like most from the Palatine Hill. I wish I did not look so delicate. My name is Lysander Auloon. I was named for a contradiction, a Spartan general who had the mind of an Athenian. Like that man, I was born into something that is both mine and not mine, a heritage of world-breakers and tyrants. 700 years after my ancestor, Selinius Auloon, conquered Earth, I was born the son of Brutus Auarchus and Anastasia Auloon, heir to empire. Now that empire is a fractured, sick land, so drunk in war and political upheaval, it's likely to devour itself in my lifetime. But that is no longer my inheritance. When I was a boy, the day after the fall of House Loon, Cassius bent on a knee and told me his noble mission. Gold forgot it was intended to shepherd, not rule. I reject my life and honour that duty, to protect the people. Will you join me? I had no family left. My home was at war. I was afraid, and more than that, I wanted to be good. So I said yes, and for the last 10 years we have patrolled the fringes of civilization, protecting those who cannot protect themselves in the Reaper's new world. Roving between asteroids and backwater docks in the asteroid belt as the spheres change around us and war rages in the core. Cassius brought us here in search of redemption, but no matter how many traders we save from pirates or foundered ships we rescue, his eyes remain dark and I still dream of the demons from my past. I pull on a moth-eaten grey pullover and weave my way barefoot through the ship after Cassius, running my hands along the walls. "Hello, girl," I say. "You're sounding tired today." The Archimedes is an old 50-meter Whisper-class corvette of the once great Ganymede dockyards, with 3 guns and engines fast enough to push her from Mars to the belt in under 4 weeks at near orbit. Shaped like a reared cobra head, she's made for scouting, raids. 100 years ago, she was top of the line, but she's seen better days. The larger part of my adolescent chores was scrubbing rust from the inside hull, oiling her gears, and patching her electrical innards. But for all that tending, it's the Archie's scars I love the most. Little beauty marks that make her our home. A dent under the kitchen's oven where Cassius fell and struck his head when drinking long ago, after news reached us of Darrow and Virginia's wedding. Charred ceiling panels made by the fire that Pytha started when she brought me a birthday pie when I was 12 and put the candles too close to a leaking oxygen pipe. Scratches on the walls of the Razor training room. So many memories here woven together like those poems above my bed. I enter the cosy, ovular cockpit. There is room for a pilot and 2 recessed seats for observation. Its original military lighting has been stripped out and replaced by warmer nodes. A thick Andalusian rug covers the floor. Several rows of mint and jasmine grow atop the console, presents I acquired for Pytha from a Violet's streetside botany shop in the Hanging Market on Ceres. Incense from the Arabian Mountains, not far from Cassius's family home on Mars, burns in the corner. Cassius and Pytha, our blue pilot, peer out the cockpit windows. Outside is the cargo hauler that drew us off our course to Lacrimosa Station. We were en route for ship repairs after last month's skirmish with Martian Scar Hunters when we received the distress signal from the gulf between Republic space and Rim territory. I told Cassius it was too dangerous to investigate so low on provisions, but his heart guides us more than his head these days. The ship out the viewport is a giant cube 500 metres at the edge. Most of her decks are exposed to vacuum by design, while superstructure lattice holds together thousands of cargo containers. Her tag IDs her as the Vindabona out of the Trade Hub series. She sits adrift and dark, a very odd, very dangerous thing in the Gulf. Several wild asteroids the size of cities float between us, ice crystals on their surfaces winking in the dark. We used one to mask our approach. The Vindabona's civilian instruments would never detect a military ship like ours in this briar patch, but it's not the hauler that worries me. I scan the sensors for ghosts in the darkness. "Well, she's a deep space mule bitch, all right," Pytha murmurs in a monotone delivery that erodes punctuation and inflection. Probably packed 100 million credits of iron. Slag me, but that's a crew I'd like to be on. Must you swear so early in the morning, I ask? Shit, sorry, moon boy, forgot to mind my fucking manners. Pytha is in her late 50s, with distant, pale blue eyes and skin the colour of a walnut. Like all blues, she still harbours the neurodevelopmental sculpting that enhances human-to-computer interaction, but impairs communication outside her sect. She doesn't have the social niceties of the Palatine shuttle pilots. My teacher grimaces. Crew will make scratch, he says. Captain might get a share to keep him loyal, but that's 100 million credits of some trade lord's coin floating out there. A share, you say? What a novel idea for a captain to snag a share, Pytha says. Pity you're a pilot and not a captain. Come now, Bellona. Between you and Moonboy over here, you've got to have a dozen secret vaults. Why else do you think I signed up? Certainly wasn't your chiseled chin, Dominus, she says, the word sarcastically. I'm sure you eagles have squirreled away some chit in hidden nests. Pytha snorts a strange little laugh to herself and looks back to the data stream as letters and symbols trickle past. The untrained ear would hear the Martian drawl in her voice and be done with it, but I catch the spice of Thessalonica, that city of grapes and duels that sprawls white and hot by Mars's thermic sea. Best known for the short tempers of its citizenry and the long list of deeds done by its most illustrious sons, the Blackguard Brothers' Wrath. That Thessalonican swagger is likely what got her expelled from the Midnight School and reduced to smuggling before her path crossed ours 8 years ago. When Cassius learned she was Martian, he freed her from the brig of a mining city where she was imprisoned for a smuggling offence, and she's worked for us ever since. I've certainly learned new words since she came aboard. Bald and barefoot, Pytha leans back in the pilot's chair, sipping coffee from the plastic dinosaur mug I won her in an arcade on Phobos years back. She's in grey cotton pants and wears her old sweatshirt. Her limbs are thin as a grasshopper's, the right bent under her, the left hanging off the side of the chair, which is shaped like half of a hard-boiled quail egg with the yolk scooped out. A second skin of stickers and decals from children's video games festoons its grey metal backside. The ship may belong to Cassius, but Pytha's left her mark. Sander, what do you think? My teacher looks back at me. I examine the ship out the viewport. Cassius sighs. Out loud. She's a VD, Uruk Z Cosmos Hola, fourth generation, by my guess. Don't equivocate, we both know you're not guessing. I wipe sleep from my eyes, annoyed. She has 125 million cubic meters of hauling capacity. One main Gastron helium reactor, built in the Venusian yards, circa 520 PCE. Crew of 40, one industrial docking bay, two secondary tubes. Obviously, she's a smuggler. Sounds like the human encyclopedia's got a turd up his nose, Pytha drawls. She pours a cup of coffee from her carafe and hands it back to me. I wish it were tea. The last of the beans till we hit Lacrimosa. Sip wisely, peevish one. I slip into the seat behind hers and take a mouthful of the coffee, wincing at the heat. Apologies, I neglected to eat supper. I neglected to eat supper, Pytha repeats, mocking my accent. Born on the Palatine Hill of Luna, I have lamentably inherited the most egregiously stereotypical high lingo accents. Apparently others find it hilarious. Haven't we servants to spoon-feed His Majesty supper? Oh, shut your gory gob, I say, modulating my voice to mimic the Thessalonican bravado. Better? Eerily so. Skipping supper. No wonder you're a little twig, Cassius says, pinching my arm. I dare say you didn't even weigh 110 kilos, my good man. It's usable weight, I protest. In any matter, I was reading. He looks at me blankly. You have your priorities, I have mine, muscly creature, so piss off. When I was your age, you despoiled half the women on Mars, I say, and probably thought it was their honour. Yes, I'm aware. Forgive me, but I find books of passion more illuminating than carnivals of flesh. He looks at me in amusement. One day a woman is going to make a pretty meal of you. Spoken like a man who barely escaped the lion's jaws, I reply. Pytha goes still and stares at Cassius for a long, awkward moment, as her arithmetical brain endeavours in vain to divine whether he is offended or not. I sip my coffee again and nod to the ship. To the matter, no legitimate Mars or Lunar Corps would send that poor girl out to the Gulf without escort, not with Askamani about. Those Julie Barker solar markings are false flags, wrong shade of red on that sun, should be scarlet. But that there is vermilion. The syndicate would know that, so low-rate smugglers, like Pytha said, probably hauling ore from some off-grid mine to avoid customs. And please, stop testing me, Cassius. At this point, you know that I know. Cassius grunts, still stinging from the lion rejoinder. It was petty of me to say, and I feel lesser for having said it. 10 years recycling each other's air will make the best of men devils to one another. After all, that is why blues were raised in sects. No bloody way that vermilion is an actual colour, Pytha says. Of course Pytha is as much an exile from her kind as we are from our own. I can't imagine why. Sounds more like the last name of a silver, she adds. Care to wager on that, I ask gamely. She ignores me. Black hell. You gotta be a special kind of stupid to wander into the belt without legs to run or claws to fight. Nearest Republic gunship is 10 million clicks away. She finishes her coffee and bites into the iron blueberry tail of a Cosmos Comet caffeine gummy. She offers me the remaining white tail, which I decline. Suppose the distress signal was an accident? Didn't last long. Doubtful, Cassius replies. It's too dark to tell if there are any carbon scoring markings along the outside of the Vindobona, the telltale sign of a forced breach. I don't find any, but that hardly disproves their existence. Pytha looks back at Cassius. Do we risk hailing them? Let's not announce ourselves just yet, Cassius looks back at me and speaks the word on both our minds. Trap? Perhaps. I overdo a nod to make up for my earlier barb. He doesn't seem sore. Might be a pirate ship strapped to one of those asteroids. I dare say we've seen this one before. Emit a distress signal for bait, then sit back and wait. But it's peculiar all the way out here. If it is a trap, it's a poorly conceived one. Who would run across it? No one likes the Gulf. So we should investigate, Cassius uses his instructor's voice. With caution, I confirm. There may be souls aboard, but we needn't risk the Archy just yet. My mind exactly. So what do we do, my good man? I smile and put down my coffee. Well, Cassius, I dare say we should put on our dancing shoes. Cassius and I float through space toward an oblong asteroid. It rotates lazily in the darkness. Veins of ice glitter and wind through her craggy skin as we coast into a rock formation at the edge of a shadowy canyon, large enough to swallow the citadel of light. We arrest our motion on a jagged scree. My breath echoes in my ears. Darkness stretches under me, plunging into the fathomless depths of the asteroid. I doubt very much any man has ever set foot upon this cold chunk of rock, much less looked into its bowels. I feel it's my duty to give in to temptation and shine a light down into the canyon. I flick the switch on my forearm, and a beam of light cuts into the darkness and is devoured by the lower reaches. There is no bottom that my eye can see, but at least now a man's eye has seen that. Turn that off, Cassius orders over the comm. Apologies, was looking for space worms. Biologically absurd, Pytha mutters from the cockpit. Organic tissue must have calories. What would they eat? Spacemen, I say with a smile. Space boys, Cassius corrects. I'm certain that had I been born in a different time, I would have been an explorer. Since I was a boy, I've had an insatiable itch for things remote and unknown. In the Citadel, I dreamt of sailing the violent light of distant nebulas and charting astral seas. The great philosopher Sagan once preached it was in our nature as a species to explore. Despite the modern chaos, we do live in a new age of innovation. Perhaps some brilliant boy or girl who has yet to take their first step will one day make an engine to carry us faster than the speed of light beyond our single star, beyond the stain of man. Would all this chaos be worth that one innovation? I often imagine what humans could do if there were no scarcity. Nothing to fight over, just an unending expanse to explore and name and fill with life and art. I smile at the pleasant fiction. A man can dream. Not wanting to bring the Archimedes into a trap, Cassius and I pushed away from her airlock toward the nearest asteroid in our Evo suits 15 minutes ago. Now we reorient ourselves and push off again toward the hulking Vindobona. Rows and rows of cargo containers drift suspended between metal beams, bound together by wires and mesh netting. Cassius and I use our shoulder thrusters to slow our approach, settling into the floating carbon mesh that pins in a row of green crates. They are stamped with Republic stars. With Pytha guiding us over the comms, We pull ourselves along the outside of the ship toward the central service airlock. There I unscrew the paneling on the door's locking mechanism and hijack the console till the orange doors open silently. Cassius and I drift into the airlock. The outer door closes behind us. We each grip the metal rungs inside. Red light throbs down from the ceiling as the airlock finishes its cycle. Pressure slowly pumps into the room, then oxygen, finally the pull of gravity. We remove our razors from their holsters on our hips. A pair of lazy silver tongues of metal float in the air, 2 meters long, stiffening to just over a meter of sword as we toggle them to their rigid state. His is straight. I prefer mine in the slight crescent of my house. The red light becomes green, and the interior door of the airlock opens with an asthmatic gasp. As ever, Cassius makes sure he's the first through before glancing back to make sure I follow. The repair bay is empty except for tools and ancient Evo suits hanging from hooks. Pale lights embedded in the grey ceiling flicker, hurling shadows about the room. An indicator blinks green, and so I retract my helm into a small compartment at the back of the neck and breathe in the scent of cleaning solution and oil. Reminds me of my early days with Cassius, hiding out in backwater transportation hubs, searching for a ship to carry us away from Luna. Away from the Rising. That was a lonely time. The better part of me felt carved away as we fled from Luna, and I knew I would never again hear my grandmother say my name. Never follow Aja along the garden paths to train before the morning packlebell birds even woke. All the people who had ever loved me were gone. I was alone, and not just alone, but hunted. I shoved the memories in the void where my grandmother taught me to stow them lest they overwhelm me like they did her when she was a girl. Eagle to Mother Hen, we're inside. Level 16, no signs of life, Cassius says. Copy, Eagle. Do try to use words first this time instead of blades. Unlike certain pilots I know, I have impeccable manners, Mother Hen. Captain, she stresses. Call me Captain. As you say, pilot. Cassius lets his helmet retract and winks at me. His face is harder than when we first met, but every now and again there's that twinkle in his eyes, like a light inside a far-off tent, making you feel warm even though you're still outside. And I am outside. He thinks I don't see how wounded he is, how I'm a replacement for the brother Darrow of Lycos took from him in the Institute. Sometimes he looks at me, and I know he sees Julian. A small, selfish part of me wishes he just saw me. I follow Cassius into the hall. The ship is barren and gripped by silence. Something here is amiss. Quietly we make our way through the ship, but before we've gone long, we find a smear of blood on the floor leading from a side passage to a central lift. We trace the blood to the starboard escape pod bay, and there, before the large doors, we find a massacre. Gore congeals on the walls, bodily fluids pool on the dented floor, the whole room redolent with the tangy scent of iron and sick, so much so that I would gag were I not conscious of Cassius's eyes on me. Red handprints streak the escape pod door, as if men were trying to claw their way out. Yet there are no bodies. I focus and try to view the room with the mind's eye, removed, analytical, as my grandmother trained me. The crew was killed here, under a day ago, I say, examining the state of the blood. When I was a boy, my grandmother had Securitas investigators take me to murder scenes in Hyperion City to teach me the barbarism under the surface of civilization, under the manners of men. I bend on a knee and begin processing the scene. Judging from the blood spatters, I would postulate that there were two assailants, men or women of our size or larger, judging by their boot prints. No blast scoring or char indicates the work was done with blades and hammers. Ask Amani, Cassius says darkly. Evidence suggests it. I take a sample of the blood on my finger and wipe it on the datapad built into a socket on my Evo suit's left forearm. Brown, red, and blue DNA markers. Our smugglers. Several were killed and then dragged out. Others were still alive. You watching, Pytha? Cassius asks. Yes, she says quietly over the comm. Our suits feed her visuals as well. She's more sensitive to violence than we are. No sign of ship signatures from the Gulf. But if it's all the same, will you please hurry it up? I've got an itch about this. As do I. The term Askamani is derived from the Germanic for ashmen. The first Vikings sailed down European rivers in boats of ashwood, and ash is what they left behind. Once the Askamani were just deep space legends, dark whispers passed by traders and smugglers to new recruits in the shadowy, hollows of asteroid cantinas, or docking bay watering holes. In the deep of space, so they'd say, there lurked obsidian tribes who escaped the society's culling of the rest of their race following the Dark Revolt hundreds of years ago. Hunted by my family's extermination squads and Olympic knights, they fled into the darkness. For years they plagued the far colonies of Neptune and Pluto, remaining little more than myth to the core. But now, with the obsidian diaspora from the poles of Earth and Mars, that myth has become reality. Bands of obsidians, alienated by the new strange world, freed from military slavery to gold masters, or exhausted from the Reaper's War, embrace the legend of their ancestors. They've not so much left the ice as they've brought the ice to the stars. Inside the lift, where the blood trail ends, Viscera smear the button for the 13th deck. Cassius presses it with the hilt of his razor. I feel the righteous anger building in my friend as we rise. It infects me. The lift wheezes to a stop, shuddering as the doors part and reveal the hall leading into the 13th floor of the old vessel. Cheap white lights burn down at derelict halls, casting wicked, sharp shadows. Air ventilators with clogged purifiers rattle in the ceiling. Down the centre of the hall, a red trail bifurcates the rusted metal flooring. Handprints smear the ground to either side of the trail like crimson butterfly wings. Cassius leads, and I follow the trail, our razors held behind us at a diagonal as Aja taught us, our Aegis arms held before us, braces cold and inert but ready to spring into a meter-square energy shield at a moment's notice. My new plasma pistol is light against my right thigh. Faded yellow signs on the walls indicate washrooms and crew quarters. We check the rooms as we go. The first several are abandoned. Unmade beds and overturned pictures and chairs remain as evidence of violence. The crew was caught sleeping. Inside the next room, we find what's left of the crew. Corpses have been stacked in a heap against the far wall. A stagnant pool of blood expands from the pile, and in it I see the reflection of a single, terrified eye. I rush to the pile and pull the dead to the side to find six shivering survivors beneath the corpses. They're bound and beaten, and tied feet to hands. I bend to free them, but they flinch away, making inhuman squealing sounds. Cassius bends to a knee and removes his right gauntlet so they can see the gold sigils on his hand. "Salve," he says in a deep voice. The prisoners calm, the sign bringing them courage. "Salve, friends," he says as their eyes search his face and see the peerless scar there, a scar I've never earned. "Dominus," they murmur, weeping. "Dominus." "Peace. We've come to help you," I say as I ungag a paunchy red man. One of his eyes is swollen shut from a gash at the eyebrow. He smells like urine. "How many are there?" I ask. His crooked teeth chatter together so terribly he cannot even utter a single word. I wonder if he's ever spoken to a gold. I feel such pity for him. I rest a hand on his shoulder, intending to comfort him. He flinches back. "Goodman, salve, peace," I say softly. "You are safe now. We've come to help. Tell me how many there are." 15, maybe more, Dominus," he whispers in a thick Phobosian accent, fighting back tears. I look over at Cassius. 15 is too many without our pulse armor. "Leader is on the bridge with the captain. Are you moon lords?" "How did they board you?" I ask, ignoring his question. "Do they have a vessel?" He nods. "Came from the asteroids, they did. Theryx, our helmsman, fell asleep, blinked, drunk," he shudders. We woke and they were in the halls, tried to run, to get to escape pods. They punished us." His crooked teeth chatter together. I'm so close I can see the blackheads on his bulbous nose. The veins on his neck stand out from fluid redistribution from extended travel in low gravity. He's pallid and weak in the bones. I wager it's been half a life since he's felt the sun's warmth. "Their ship boarded through the cargo hangar." "Explains why we couldn't see it," I say to Cassius. He ignores me. "Why are you so far out here with full freight?" he asks the man.
"Shouldn't have been. Shouldn't have taken the money."
"The money from whom?" I ask.
"The passenger. The gold."
Cassius and I exchange a glance. "There's a gold on board?" he asks. "Did they have a scar?"
"Not peerless."
The red shakes his head, and Cassius breathes a small sigh of relief. "She came to the captain on Psyche. Paid us too." He swallows, glancing over our shoulders as if expecting an obsidian to appear there.
She paid us to drop her at an asteroid, S1392.
That's near the edge of the Gulf, I say, just outside Rim territory.
Yeah, Captain told her nothing was there, but she paid us much our freight. Told him we shouldn't get involved with golds, but he didn't listen. He never listens.
Did she give a name? Cassius asks.
No name, the man shakes his head. But she sounded like him.
He points at me, and I know Cassius has the same thought. Are the obsidians here for the ship or the gold? They might not be Askamani, I say. Could be the Rising.
Darrow wouldn't mask as civilians.
In this war, 2/3 of the dead are civilians, I say sharply. Have you forgotten the sack of Luna by Sephi's horde?
Not at all, nor have I forgotten you thieves, Cassius replies, referring to when my godfather, the Ash Lord, orbitally bombarded one of Mars's great cities after she fell to the Rising.
Boys, Pythor's voice crackles in our ears, cutting through the tension between us. Boys, we have company.
How many? Cassius asks.
3 ships inbound.
I stand.
3?
How the gory hell are you just telling us? Cassius snaps.
Couldn't pick them up because of the asteroid interference. They must have called in more of them to haul in the Vindobona.
The crew members sense our unease and begin to shudder again in fear.
What grade, I ask? Military, 3rd class. 2 4-gun lancers and an 8-gun storm-class corvette. They're Askamani.
How can you tell, I ask?
They have bodies on their hulls.
It's a gory damn hunting party, Cassius curses quietly.
We could go toe-to-toe with one of the lancers, but a storm-class corvette would rip Arky to shreds.
How long do we have?
5 minutes. Haven't yet spotted me. I suggest you get off that heap.
I rush to cut the remaining restraints off the prisoners. Hen, I need you to pop off that asteroid and burn for the Vindobona's transfer tube, Cassius says. We have people to evacuate.
They'll see me if I make an approach, Pythor says.
They might have guns, but we've got engines, Cassius replies.
Copy.
Can you all run? Cassius asks the crew. They stare up at him without answering.
Well, you're going to have to. The obsidians are still out there. You see them, you keep it together, and get to the tube. Let us fight. You obey everything I say, or I leave you to die. I need you to nod.
They do.
Good.
What about the gold? I ask Cassius. They could still be alive.
You heard, Pythor, he replies. We don't have time. I won't leave someone behind for those barbarians to keep, especially not one of us. It is not honourable.
I said no, Cassius snaps, almost using my name in front of the smugglers. It's not worth the risk of all their lives for one person.
He surveys the wobbling crew before us.
Everyone quiet. Stay together, now follow me.
Cassius, as always, is first out the door before I can reply. The prisoners follow quick as they can into the hall back the way we came. I guard the rear, helping along a limping Brown. The bone of his right arm sticks out of a tear in his green jumpsuit. Cassius looks back to make sure I'm keeping pace. We load into the lift we rode up on to take it back down to the 3rd level. But as the doors begin to close, I jump off the lift without a glance back at Cassius.
Damn it, boy!
Cassius says over the comm after the doors seal and the lift carries downward. What do you think you're doing?
What Lorne would do, I reply, walking back the way we came.
He says we don't have time, but I know how careful he is with me, how cautiously he guards my life.
I'll be sensible. Make a quick reconnoiter.
He's quiet for a moment, and I know he's reserving his condemnation for later.
Hurry, but watch your tail.
Naturally. I adjust my hand on my razor and move back down the hall. I take efforts to calm my breath, but every corner I turn, I expect to see a savage waiting with bloody teeth and hollow eyes. I feel the fear and remember my grandmother's words. Do not let fear touch you. Fear is the torrent, the raging river. To fight it is to break and drown, but to stand astride it is to see it, feel it, and use its course for your own whims. I am the master of my fear. I let myself sink into the mind's eye. My breathing slows, a cold, distant clarity settles over me. I hear the rattle of air purifiers clogged by dust, the pulse of generators vibrating through the metal floor into my boots, and then I hear them. The low, quiet rumble of their voices drifts down the dark metal hall like a grumbling glacier. My hands sweat inside gloves. Everything Arja and Cassius taught me seems so distant now as the metal grating underneath my boots creaks. I've killed Askamani before, but never by myself. At the end of the hall, I peer around the corner. I don't see the obsidians. The commissary is round and holds several tables, the centermost of which has been laden with mounds of clothing.
I'm about to move into the room when the mound moves and I realize my mistake. Three Askamani sit at the center table. Their long braided hair cascades white and dirty down broad backs. Pale, scarred skin peeks out from under scrap armor. They speak in Nagal and are hunched together, eating and drinking the food stores from the ship. Revulsion and fear swirl together in the pit of my belly. Be the calm. I lean back behind the wall and listen to their conversation. The savages' accents are thick, their voices sluggish and drunken, from Earth's North Pole. One criticizes the flavor of the man-meat and longs to eat fresh elk. His friend says something I do not understand, something about the ice. Another is irritated that she claimed no slaves in the taking of the ship. She asks if she could buy the Sunborn from the first. He laughs at her with his mouth full and says she belongs to their Jarl, body and meat. The Sunborn, the gold. I expect Lorne would kill them. My own pride would see me do the same, to prove to myself that I am greater than the fear I now feel. But pride is a vanity I cannot afford. My grandmother's lessons win out. Why fight when you can maneuver? I find a way around the commissary and continue my search, listening for any sound of life. My pre-allotted time ticks away. I'll have to double back in 2 minutes. There's nothing but the obsidian voices echoing down the halls and the unhappy rattle of distant generators. Then I hear something. A faint creaking from behind a bulkhead. I find the door and clasp the narrow handle. It opens slowly, sliding back into its frame and squealing as it goes. I wince, praying to Jove that no one heard. I wait, poised with my razor in the hall for the obsidians to come running. None do. I slip into the room. It is filled with the rest of the crew. They litter the floor in mesh cages that constrict around their bodies, all low colours, and hanging above them from the dark room ceiling is a thin wire net that's been looped around a gas pipe. It sways back and forth, and inside it, and hanging upside down as the wire cuts into her bare skin, is the body of a naked woman with gold sigils upon the backs of her hands.
Chapter 11. Darrow, Servant of the People. The room bursts into a chaos of thrust fists and rippling togas. Only the obsidians do not move. Seffi watches the reaction with a neutral expression, unreadable as ever. Mustang turns on me in a fury. Is this true? He never wanted peace, I say coldly. Severo is rocking in his feet in an effort to keep himself from strangling Julia Albalona in the middle of the forum. But did he send emissaries?
He sent provocateurs, her and Asmodeus. It was a ruse that I did not warrant worth the time of this body.
Mustang can't believe what she's hearing. Darrow,
Asmodeus was on your ship, and you did not report this to us?
Dancer asks, incredulous. Someone betrayed me. Someone in the Howlers. How else would he know? I fix my gaze on Dancer.
The Ash Lord burned Rhea. He burned New Thebes. He'd burn every city left to win back Luna. He wants the home we've stolen from him.
Dancer shakes his head.
You had no right.
Caraval and those coppers who cheered me watch with uncertainty. Mustang has not moved from her chair, nor can she. Whatever she says will be dismissed as a wife defending her husband, and might indict her as well. If they think she knew, she'll be impeached, possibly worse, which is the very reason why I hid this from her. My star is falling. If she holds on, it will drag her down too. Better to stay quiet, my love. Better to play the long game. I know better than to struggle. A red senator lurches up from her seat and rushes across the floor. For a moment, I think she means to speak in my defense. Then she spits at my feet.
Gold, she says.
Wulfgar eases forward to dissuade any others from breaking protocol. For years I waited for this day to come, but as the Republic grew in strength, it never did. and I suppose I tricked myself into thinking it wouldn't. But now that it's here, now that I feel the blind hate rising, and see the unpitying lenses of the cameras in the viewing deck above, I know how words will be lost on them. The noble newscasters will sanctimoniously peel at every decision, every secret, every sin, and stream them across the worlds, feigning duty, but delighting in the moral bloodshed, masticating my bones, cracking them for the marrow of ratings, and feeding their vulture appetite for gossip. I'm not surprised, but I am heartbroken. I don't want to be the villain. Wolfgar looks back at me pityingly, as if wishing he could carry me away from this public shaming. Severo is standing from his seat in a rage. "You fucking backstabbing little rat," he says to Dancer. "How can we trust you with our armies?" Dancer booms. "When you disobey the Senate, when you lie to the people." He does not give me time to respond. "My brothers and sisters, there is no place in our republic for warlords or tyrants. They are the death of democracy. Our 700 years of slavery stands testament to that. But tyranny did not just spring up. It bubbled up slowly as the leaders of Earth watched and did nothing. We must choose. Is our republic ruled by its voice or by its sword?" He sits, his work done. Amidst a roar of approval that spreads to more than just his usual supporters, Dancer of Faran, the hand of Ares who pulled me from the grave to make me a weapon, buries me under my own designs. And across the room, like a noble old olive tree, neither flame nor axe can fell, Julia Aubelona watches me with hate in her gnawing eyes. Slowly, as if a long-forgotten promise is finally being delivered, she begins to smile. Publius su Caraval stands in the chaos. Only by Mustang hammering her scepter on the ground can she quiet the senators enough for the copper to speak. If anyone could find something to say to defend me, it would be him. "I do not share all the convictions of the Red Senator. There cannot be peace while there is no justice. But in one matter, I fear he strikes the mark. You have overstepped, Arch-Imperator. You have forgotten your oaths made to serve the people." He turns to the senators, summoning firm courage to overcome the betrayal. "I propose a vote to remove Darrow of Lycos from High Command and to place him under house arrest pending a trial for acts of treason against the Republic." Applause follows this. He looks back at me dramatically. "And I propose a temporary cessation of hostilities with the Golds of the Corps so that we may decide ourselves between war and peace." The sanctimonious bastard. There is little Mustang can do. At her instructions, Republic wardens come to escort all non-senators from the room. I let Wolfgar guide me out. Over the heads of his men, I see my wife watching me from her chair, fear in her eyes because she sees the rage in mine. Outside the building, the world is quiet and untouched by my humiliation. Republic wardens stand illuminated by the warm glow of blue lamps as we collect our weapons. Lesser bureaucrats thread their way across the plaza, tending to the affairs of a government responsible for 10 billion lives. Dusk is over now, and the sky is black. Autumn leaves roll across the white marble expanse. "Darrow, you are not to leave the city," Wolfgar says to me. "Do you hear me?" He puts his hand on my shoulder again. "Darrow, Am I under arrest? I ask.
Not yet.
You need to step back, Severo says, his fingers tightening around the razor at his side.
Wulfgar looks down at Severo, who comes barely to his sternum, and steps back in respect. I descend the stairs away from the forum, heading for the landing pads in the North Citadel. Severo catches up to me. I stop and look back at the forum as a loud cheer leaks out the open door.
Some little shit told them, Severo says. I should carve Caraval's balls off. Treason! They can't actually arrest you, can they?
They might not put me in Deepgrave, but they'll lock me up for as long as they think they don't need me. Long enough for the Ash Lord to make his move. Severo sneers.
The Seventh Legion will have something to say about that. Should I call Orion? The Telemanuses? Kavax should be on his way back from Mars.
I look back to the forum. Inside, Mustang will be attempting to repair the damage done. But with Copper lost, she won't have the votes to protect me. There's nothing more I can do here. This isn't my world. I knew it before, and Dancer just reminded me. The man says, "All I know is war." And he is right. In my heart, I know my enemy. I know his mettle. I know his cruelty. And I know this war will not end with politicians smiling at each other from across a table. It will only end as it began, with blood. No, Severo. Summon the Howlers.
Chapter 10. Darrow. Liberty Eternal. Severo squirms on the white cushion next to me as Publius Sue Caraval, the Copper Tribune, leader of the Copper Bloc, finishes the roll call. He's an elegant firebrand of a man, middle-aged, small of stature, with a narrow, pleasant face, a large nose, cold eyes, and an ambivalence toward fashion that borders on antagonism. When he's not in his toga, he still wears the same drab suits he did as a public low-colour defence lawyer before the war. Since then, he's risen to become a voice of reason in the divided Senate, and an occasional ally of my wife's. They call him the Incorruptible for his punctilious nature and lack of vices. Caraval stands on a small circular plinth before the tiered, C-shaped marble steps that encircle the white and red porphyry floor. Small wooden chairs are set for each senator on the steps. Behind Caraval, recessed from the plinth, squats the unadorned mourning chair of the sovereign. Made of white wood, carved with simple geometric designs, the chair looks dreadfully uncomfortable and is without cushion. Mustang had it removed. She leans against one of the arms of the chair and watches the senators. They sit, clustered by colour and political affiliation, upon the cushioned steps. Dancers, vox populi, to the left of the huge liberty doors that lead out of the forum to the steps and the Via Triumphia. Mustang's optimates sit to the right. Obsidian and copper centrists occupy the middle. Bored by the formality, Severo lounges beside me in crisp military whites. He's staring at the ceiling, infatuated by the mural there. It is a romantic rendering of the Phobos address, my speech that launched the rising on Phobos 10 years ago. I look young and radiant in paints of gold and scarlet and float on grav boots, cape billowing behind me like a magenta storm cloud, flanked by Howlers, the sons of Ares, and Ragnar, even though he wasn't exactly there. Severo's jaw clenches.
That doesn't look anything like me.
He nods to his own image. He's right. The eyes of the rendering are blood red and insane. His hair standing on end. His teeth look like rows of shattered porcelain.
You look like a bloody saint, ploughed an angel, and out you popped. I look like a deranged fucking mutant that eats babies. I pat Severo on the leg. Mustang catches my eye and nods up to the last of the red senators who have just entered the room. Dancer shuffles along at the head of the procession of my people to their seats. He feels my eyes and meets them without a smile. Even knowing he's my adversary of the day, it's hard not to feel fondness for him. With the roll call finalized, I turn my attention to Mustang. A quorum being present, the floor will now hear the scheduled petition. She looks to me. Arch Imperator. The sound of my boots on stone echoes through the Senate chamber as I go to take my place on the plinth facing the senators. I spy Daxa, who sits surrounded by his fellow gold senators on the far right. He looks like a statue of some pagan god in repose, though I know he's still nursing as monstrous a hangover as I am. Only when the tension has reached its pinnacle do I finally speak. Mercury is liberated. The right half of the senators, along with the coppers, led smoothly by Caraval, roar their approval. The First Fleet of the Republic, under the command of Imperator Orion Z. Aquarii, met that of the Ash Lord over Mercury, while the Second Fleet, under my personal command, launched an iron rain against the continent of Borealis. Through high cost, we prevailed. The high-color senators lead the room to their feet again, roaring their fanatical support for the war effort. The Vox Populi remain silent, and so, I notice, do the Obsidians. Now the Ash Lord is in retreat. He has recalled the greater sum of his forces to make a final stand at Venus, but soon we will follow. Brothers and sisters, we stand upon the threshold of victory. It is a full minute before the renewed applause dies down. But we yet have a choice to make. I take my time, allowing the silence to grow again. Do we allow this war to linger, to consume another generation of our young? Or do we press the enemy and grind them until the last of the chains have been shattered? I speak over the applause this time, letting the fervor spread through me. It has been a decade of war, but we can end it here, now. I spare a look up to the viewing deck above, where the Holo Networks have their cameras. My enemy will be watching this later with his daughter and advisors, his nimble mind dissecting my words, divining my plans based on the response of these senators. But more importantly, he'll be watching me. He must not see my exhaustion. Mercury was a great victory. We robbed him the iron of his docks. But Venus? Venus is the prize. Even here, amidst the thunderous applause of the right, I hear Lorne's words echo in the dark place of my mind. Death begets death begets death. Brothers and sisters of the Republic, we are one choice away from a fully liberated core, a free system from Sol to the asteroid belt. We would be the first men and women to ever see it. But it will be a sight not without cost. I pause and permit, for one small moment, the weight of these last years to show on my face. Like you, I wish for nothing more than peace. I wish for a world where the machine of war does not swallow our young. I look to my wife. I wish to live in a world where my child can choose his own destiny, where the sins of the past do not define the nature of his life, as it has defined all of ours. Our enemies have held dominion over us for too long, first as slaves, then adversaries. And what stability, what
harmony can we bring to the worlds we have freed while they continue to define us? For the sake of our brothers and sisters on Venus and Mercury, I looked to Dancer, for the sake of the souls we have unchained, for the sake of our children, give me the tools, and I will finish this war once and for all. They roar in approval. I look to Daxo, and, as we agreed, he stands to tower over his fellow senators. My noble friends, his large hands splay plaintively outward, I know you are weary. I feel the years of war in my bones, too. I believe I had hair when this all began. There's laughter. I know better than you the heart of the peerless Skard. They do not have the spirit for peace. It is not in their nature to accept this new world we have made. They must be defeated by all measures at our disposal. My family has supported the Reaper since before he was known. My brother died for him. I have fought for him. And I will not abandon him now, nor should you. The Optimates stand with the Reaper, and we propose a bill to the floor for a resolution of liberty eternal to draft 20 million fresh troops, to allocate ships from the Gulf, and to levy additional taxes to fund the war effort until the Corps is free. Daxo sits back down and makes a pained expression in my direction and rubs his temple. Publius Su Carvajal rises from his seat when the applause finally fades. His short copper hair is parted on the side, not a strand out of place. I was told I was brought into this world to serve, to move the invisible levers of an ancient and evil machine. We all moved those levers, but now we serve the people. We are here to liberate the dignity of man. Darrow of Lycos is our greatest weapon against tyranny. Let us sharpen him again so he can break the chains for our brothers and sisters in bondage on Venus. He touches his heart, bleeding empathy and resolution. A chorus of senators declare their support, each shouting over the next. Mustang stands, hammering down her dawn scepter. The resolution is registered by the Senate and now open for debate. All eyes turn to Dancer. He has not yet moved. Mustang analyzes his face. Senator O'Farran, she says. Nothing.
Thank you, my sovereign.
He picks at the edges of his toga in his nervous habit before rising to his feet. To this day he loathes public speaking. His voice is hoarse and halting, as far from Publius's as possible.
Arch-Imperator, my friend, my brother, can I first begin by saying how happy I am to have you home? There is no greater son of the Republic.
Many heads nod.
I would also like to personally offer you congratulations on the partial liberation of Mercury. Despite your methods, which I will get to in a spit.
I watch him warily, knowing what he intends, but not how it's meant to be delivered.
You all know I am a man of war.
He looks at his rough hands.
I have held weapons. I have led men. It's what I am. And, like most of you, I am also a mortal in a war of giants.
He looks at the golds, the obsidians.
But I have learned that giants can be felled with words. Words are our salvation. So, I stand here before you, armed only with that voice.
He pauses, grimacing to himself.
And I want to ask you, what aid do you want to live in? One where the sword leads and we follow? Or an age where our voice can sing louder than an engine can roar? Was that not the song of Persephone? The dream of Io of Lycos? There are murmurs of agreement from his supporters. An inner bitterness wells as he insinuates my deviation from Io's dream. She was mine, and I lost her to them. But each time she's mentioned, even in reverence, it seems to me as though she's been dug from the ground and paraded for the crowd.
Senators, we have no power in and of ourselves, Dancer continues slowly. We are just vessels, men and women chosen to speak for the people, by the people, to channel their voice to protect the people. Darrow, you helped give the people a voice. For that, we are in your debt. But now, you refuse to listen to that voice, to obey the laws you helped make. You are given an order by the Senate, by the people, to stand down over Mercury. You disobeyed that order. You released an iron rein.
He looks to Sephi. She sits several seats down from Severo on the guest benches, watching with an unreadable expression.
Because of your impatience, a million of our brothers and sisters died in a single day. 200,000 obsidians. 200,000. A number that cannot be replaced.
The words are heavy as they fall, and I see the solemn anger of the obsidian block, the same anger I felt from Sephi since that day.
Not only did you do this, but you illegally pillaged elements of the Fourth Fleet that guards Mars to add to your assault on Mercury. Why? Because it was necessary to 1 million souls.
I knew 37 of those souls, and somehow that number seems larger than 1 million.
A man once said that a war fought by politicians will be lost by everyone, I say bitterly. Harnassus and Orion supported my plan. Your legions have protected you this far, but now you question them? Our legions, he asks. Are they ours?
Before I can answer, he lumbers forward, wrangling control of the conversation with all the grace of an old bear.
How many of us have lost loved ones to war? How many of us have buried sons, daughters, wives, husbands? My hands are raw from digging graves. My heart shatters seeing genocide and starvation on planets we claim free. On Mars, my home. How many more must suffer to free Mercury and Venus, planets now so indoctrinated that our own colours will fight against us for every inch of ground we take? So long as Mars is free, you're content to call it a day? Leave the others to rot? I ask.
He looks me in the eyes.
Is Mars free? Ask a red from the mines. Ask a pink in Aegea's ghetto. The yoke of poverty is as heavy as that of tyranny.
Mustang interjects. We have a solemn duty to rid the worlds of the stain of slavery. Your own words, Senator.
We also have a solemn duty to make those worlds better than they were before, Dancer replies. 200 million have died since House Loon fell. Tell me, what is the purpose of victory if it destroys us? If we are stretched so thin that we cannot protect or provide for those we bring out of the mines?
There are no weapons in the room, save those of Wolfgar and his warden. But Dancer's words do damage enough. They rattle the Senate hall, and he's not finished.
Darrow,
You stand here, asking us for more men and women, more ships to wage this war. So I ask you, and pray to the old man who guards the veil, that you can give me an answer. When will this war end? When the Republic is safe. Will it be safe when the Ash Lord falls? When we have Venus? The Ash Lord is the heart of their war machine, but he rules with fear. Without him, the remaining gold houses will turn on each other within a week. And what of the Rim? What if they come and we've smashed our armies to bits to kill one man? We have a peace treaty with the Rim. For now.
Their docks are destroyed. Octavia saw to that. The Star Hall analysts believe they could not attack us, even if they wanted to, for another 15 years, Mustang says.
Romulus does not want another war, I say. Trust me on that. Trust you?
My old friend frowns.
We have trusted you, Darrow.
I feel the same anger in him that I saw when he learned of what I did to the sons on the Rim.
So many have trusted you. For so many years. But you're in love with your own myth. You think that the Reaper knows better than the people. You think I want war? I loathe it. It's stolen my friends, my family. It takes me away from my wife, from my child. If there were another path, I would take it. But there is no path around this war. The only way is through.
He watches me for a moment.
I wonder, would you even know peace if you saw it?
He turns to the senators.
What if I told you? What if I told all of you there was another path? One that has been hidden from us?
Caraval frowns and leans forward. Severo glances my way.
What if we could have safety not tomorrow, not a decade from now? But right this very moment. Peace without another Iron Rain, without throwing millions more into the guns of the Ash Lord.
He turns to my wife.
My sovereign, I invoke my right to present a witness to the Senate body.
She's caught off guard.
What witness?
Dancer doesn't answer. He looks expectantly down the corridor to his right. At the end of it, a door opens, and a lone set of heels click against the stone floor. In hushed silence, the senators crane their necks to see a tall, imperious woman of later years striding out of the corridor into the Senate Hall. She stands a head taller than the Republic wardens, excepting Wulfgar, as she passes on the way to the center of the floor. Her eyes are gold, her body serene and slight despite her height. Her hair is spun behind her and caged by gold mesh. A gold collar in the shape of an eagle encloses her neck. Her gown is black and covering every bit of skin from her neck to her toes. And upon her regal, bitter face is a single curved scar. I glare at the woman. She has been shadow to my life ever since I beat her favorite son to death in a simple stone room 16 years ago. Now she comes to stand before the Senate.
What is the meaning of this?
Mustang demands, rising from her chair to dominate the room. Dancer does not back down.
This is Julia Aubalona, he says against the rising furore. She brings a message from the Ash Lord.
Senator!
Anger flushes Mustang's face, and she takes a violent step forward.
That is not your place. Foreign diplomacy is the province of the sovereign. You overstep.
So does your husband. But do you scold him?
He asks.
Hear what she has to say. You will find it illuminating.
The senators shout their desire to hear Bellona out. Dread enters me.
I know what Julia will say. Mustang is trapped. She looks down at the woman, both the remnants of two great gold houses that destroyed one another in their feud. Of their families, only Cassius remains. If he is still alive, somewhere out there. Say your piece, Bellona. Julia looks up at Mustang with utmost distaste. She's not forgotten how Mustang sat at their table with Cassius and then turned her back on them.
Usurper,
she says, refusing to use Mustang's honorific. Her eyes look upon the senators with aristocratic disdain.
I travelled a month to stand before you. I will speak plainly so you understand. The Ash Lord tires of war, of seeing cities turned to rubble.
She continues over shouts of protest.
During the siege of Mercury, emissaries, including myself, were sent to the Morning Star to seek audience with your warlord.
She glares at me.
We asked for an armistice. He replied with an iron rein.
Armistice? Mustang murmurs.
And why did you request an armistice?
Dancer prompts over the whispering senators.
The Ash Lord and the War Council of the Society wish to discuss terms.
What terms?
Dancer presses.
Speak plainly, Gold.
Did the Reaper not tell you?
She looks at me and smiles.
We requested a ceasefire in order to discuss the terms of a permanent and lasting peace between the Rising and the Society.
Chapter 9. Lysander, the Passenger. I rush first to the Gold. Her body is contorted and twisted inside the confines of her prison. A bent metal chair lies beneath her, having been used to beat her as she hung in the net. Her right hand is a charred, burned mess from the welding torch that sits on the table. Blood seeps there, dripping onto the floor. The smell of burned skin and hair claws into my nostrils, making my eyes water. She's dead. She has to be. Help us, a red woman whispers out of a bloody mouth. Dominus! Quiet, I snap, glancing back at the door. Dozens of pairs of eyes stare out at me from behind the cages, each prisoner pleading with me. I creep closer to the Gold, and as I reach to touch the net, her eyes flash open in the low light. Gory hell. I almost fall down. She's alive. Black engine oil has been slathered over her body, along with fouler-smelling things. Dominus, a brown hisses. Salve, I say to the Gold in a Thessalonican drawl. I'm here to help. My name is Castor Arjanus. She watches me without speaking, giving no sign that she even understands. I'm going to help you out, but you have to be quiet and quick. The Askamani is still outside. Do you understand? Yes, I understand, she says. Hers is a rich Palatine accent. It startles me. The man was right. She's from the Lunar Courts as well. What is she doing all the way out here? Stay very still, I say. I stand beneath the net and slide my razor across the steel cable, cutting it from the ceiling. The girl falls into my arms. I expect her to lash out, but she stays still within the tight mesh. I see now how deeply the tack nets cut into her skin. Tack nets, or bird cages, are fired from compressed fiber cartridges and designed for police forces to engulf and constrict around a prisoner to harmlessly subdue them. But if you toggle with the contraction restrictions, you can eviscerate a prisoner to death. I set the woman on the ground and cut the wires one by one until she's able to crawl free. She lies there naked, stretching her joints, teeth chattering with the pain. I realize now that she's young, maybe even younger than my 20 years. I feel an overwhelming urge to protect her. I cover her body with a plastic tool sheet. It is well, I say. You're safe now. I stand to go help the others. Stims, she manages through her chattering teeth. Neat stims. I bend back down and produce a syringe from the dispenser on the right thigh of my Evo suit. It's one of my last. She snatches it from my hand and stabs it into the bicep of the burned limb. Her body convulses as the drug rushes through her system. She sighs with pleasure. More, she demands. I glance at the other prisoners and produce my last two. She shocks me by injecting both at the same time. It's too much for her body mass unless she's built up a resistance to them, which inherently means something dangerous. There's something wrong here. Filled with a manic energy from the stems, she stumbles to her feet. I spring back to catch her from falling, but she steadies herself using the table. We must leave, I say softly to the girl. More Askamani are coming. We have to be gone before their ships dock. Help me with the others. Nodding along, she finds her clothing in a pile on the floor near the door. Still covered in oil, she dons the pants and a green jacket, fumbling with the zipper because of the drugs in her system. Sander, Cassius says in my ear as I bend to cut the red woman from her cage with my razor, what's your status? I found the gold, Regulus. I patch him to my visual feed. Copy, he pauses, seeing the others. Lysander? Boy, the gold says from behind me. I turn. She's less than an arm's length away. What docking tube are you using? 2B. 2B? She nods more to herself than to me. I'll return it to you in 4 minutes, on my honor. Return what? There's a blur. I don't even see her strike as the meat of her palm collides with the side of my temple. I stumble and something, maybe her elbow or knee, slams into my opposite ear and I go down, seeing stars. There's pressure on my hip, and I hear her footsteps going out the door. She's 4 seconds gone before I realize what she took. My razor, the one Cassius gave me on my 16th birthday, the one that belonged to Carnus. Its custom Bologna hilt is covered by a plain metal shell, but to Cassius it is priceless. Dazed, I lunge after her into the hallway. My legs go like rubber, and I almost fall. The low colours shout in fear, terrified that I'm going to abandon them. I lunge back toward their cages, but I don't have anything to cut with. I can't use my plasma pistol. The wire is too tight to their bodies. Panic threatens to grip me. I tug on the severed strands of the red woman's cage. Lysander, Cassius says. The low colours are clamouring now, rolling around on the floor. It's too late. I pull as hard as I can. The fibre wire of the net slices through my gloves and into my skin. Blood wells against the wire. Lysander, you have to leave them. No, I can help them. I groan as I pull with all my strength at the wire, using my legs as leverage. The wire cuts my fingers to the bone, and it doesn't even fray. There's a scream from the low colours. I wheel around and see an obsidian at the door. I grab my pistol and fire clumsily. The plasma bolt takes the obsidian's head off from the nose up. Another one fills the frame. I fire and he ducks back into the hall. Lysander, get out of there, Cassius says. A scream wells up inside but doesn't escape my lips. I stare down at the wailing low colours, at the mothers and fathers I could have freed, their cries puncturing my fantasy of heroism and honour. They thrash on the floor, screaming at me to save them, but I can't. The obsidian death warble echoes down the hall. Fear has come. I run like a coward, back into the hall, firing around the corner blindly. The obsidian's chest melts inward as he swings his axe. I bend under it and slam into the far wall, where I use the impact to push off and struggle to my feet. The obsidian's chest is burned through to the liver, but he stumbles toward me, a tower of sinewy muscle and scrap armour and the pelts of dead animals. Arja and Cassius both told me never to come within arm's reach of an obsidian. They alone can break the reinforced bones of my kind, but there's no other choice. He swings his axe again, and I charge inside the blow, hitting the inside of his axe arm with the point of my elbow, jamming the point into his brachial artery. His arm goes limp, but the force of the collision knocks me sideways. I use the momentum to flow left and drive my right knee into the genicular artery on the inside of his leg. He roars in pain and charges straight into me, slamming me against the wall. It's like the time I was kicked by one of Virginia's stallions. The breath goes out of me. His right hand grabs my throat and lifts me up against the wall, straining to crush my trachea. Cartilage crackles. I lower my jaw against his grip, but the world's going black. Bits of meat cling to his beard. The rancid smell of rotting teeth fills my nose. Twisting my body, I pull twice on the trigger of my pistol. The plasma enters under his rib cage at an angle and burns through his heart. His eyes go wide with shock and his body collapses, dead. I land and suck in air just in time to see the third obsidian raging toward me down the hall. I fire, miss, and run. Darkened hallways and empty rooms flash past. I heave myself around them, gripping girders to tighten my turns around corners. The Askamani corvette's docked on 1C, Pytha says. Dead ahead. I skid to a halt. I hear them ahead of me, their tribal voices echoing as they move into the ship through the transfer causeways. Their boots rattle the metal. Each half again my weight, maybe more. They'll cut off the route to the lift. I turn back the way I came, checking my gun's display. The energy cartridge has 17 pulls in it. I feel naked without my razor, but fighting isn't the answer today. Pytha, hallway to lift 11A is closed. I need you to guide me. Take your next left, she says without missing a beat. Conscious that Cassius is listening, judging, I take the left. 200 meters. I dash the distance, slow in my Evo suit. Maintenance lift is on your second right. I reach the lift and press the call button. It doesn't respond. A little sign's been affixed to the door itself, apologizing rather crudely for the broken lift by means of a talking phallus. Lift's out, I say, making efforts to measure my breathing. Back 20 meters, left, stairs are right there, 20 down. Back, I ask, hoping I heard wrong. Now! I backtrack without running into the obsidian and find the stairs to begin my descent. 2 levels down the stairwell, I pause. I hear them, their boots beat the stairs 2 levels above me. Through the metal grating, I see their dark shapes, their milk-pale hair. The chant, called the Kume, groans through the hall. It is a plea to Hel, obsidian goddess of death, to receive her offerings. I clear the whole next flight of stairs with a single jump, racing down the levels as fast as I can. Behind me, like a dark avalanche, gaining, rumbling, and threatening to swallow me up, rush the raiders. Can't see their numbers, can't hear what Pytha and Cassius are saying. My body is distant and numb, and my mind still and focused. I lose my footing on a rusted stair and nearly fall as the weight of the suit pulls me toward the ground. I stumble up, firing 2 quick shots with my pistol. I score a lucky hit. Someone grunts, and a shadow of blood sprays on the wall as the green energy bolts hit meat, giving me time to reach the docking level. I race through the metal door and close it behind me, cranking on the hatch as hard as I can to seal it. But the wheel stops, and then turns against me as someone stronger on the other side begins to open it. I backpedal and fire 3 shots into the hatch, turning the metal wheel into red-hot slag and jamming the door. The muscle fibers of my arm tremble from the pistol's recoil. They'll be through the door in a moment, but I bought myself precious seconds. 100 meters straight, 5th left, straight 20 meters, 1st right. I follow Pytha's instructions, but as I turn to flee the door, I slam into someone and we both go down hard. I roll as I fall and aim my pistol back up at my assailant. But it's not an obsidian. It's the gold girl. She's limping to her feet, bearing 6 new wounds on her oil-slick skin. Her jacket is in tatters. She carries my razor in her hand. It is bloody to the hilt. Clumps of white hair cling to the gore. How she is standing is a miracle. At her stomach, layers of skin and fat pull back along a 6-inch gash to the right of the belly button. Looks like an axe wound. She hunches there, listening to the obsidians hammering on the door. Give me my razor, I say. Move! She lunges toward the door with her razor and sticks it through the molten metal. A raider on the other side screams and she draws the razor back. Blood hisses as the molten metal turns it to vapor. Where's your ship? She asks, turning on me with wild, incandescent eyes. The door wheezes as the obsidians knock 1/2 off its hinges. Where is your gory damn ship? The lunar accent falters under the adrenaline in her voice, replaced by something very different. The wound in her gut is leaking blood badly. This way. I move to help her walk, but she flinches away. Don't be a fool, you can barely stand, I say. Glancing back at the bending door, she relents with a hiss of air between her teeth and throws her arm around mine. We hobble fast as we can, putting the door behind us, passing through the cargo level, containers and cranes to every side. We take a right. Cassius stands guarding the interior of the transfer bridge that connects our ship to the Vindobona, clad in his Evo suit and helm. He fires his pulse rifle over our heads at the pack that rounds the corner behind us. The distorted energy screams past my ears. There's a howl. I glance back and see an obsidian's head disappear, neck spouting blood. Magnetically shot bolts as long as my forearm rip past us and embed themselves into the wall. Then we're past Cassius and stumbling into the narrow causeway. He follows behind me, his pulse rifle roaring as he unloads the last of its battery into an obsidian warrior who jumps into the causeway after us. The man's torso tears in 1/2 and spins backward, leaving his legs behind on the causeway. Cassius kicks the legs off the ship. Disengage, he shouts to Pytha. Our bulkhead door seals, closing off the causeway as I spill with the gold girl to the transfer bay floor inside the Archimedes, panting and soaked with sweat and blood. The girl leans her forehead against the metal floor and coughs in pain. Pytha pulls an emergency disengage from the Vindobona, and we bank away. Cassius stares down at me. I feel his rage despite his helm's smooth visage. There's silence except for weeping from the crew we rescued. They're sprawled like us on the floor, huddled together, some in exultation, others still in fear, not yet believing that they could possibly be safe. They're not. You idiot, Cassius says down at me. What the hell were you thinking? Before I can answer, he kicks my razor from the girl's hands. He bends as if to grab her face to look for the dread mark on her cheek when the floor of the Arche opens up between us. He twists back and away as a fist-sized grey blur shrieks through and then goes out through the ceiling with a monstrous gasp of air. A hole has been ripped in the ship. Depressurization sirens scream, red pulses from the overhead lights. Another railgun slug pierces our hull, slamming through the floor up through the body of the paunchy red man we rescued, spraying us with his blood. Pytha shouts something in our comms. Pressure screams out of the holes. Then the cellular armor slides over the external damage and the mad gout of air stops. The sirens cease their wailing, but the warning lights continue to throb. Our engines are hit, Pytha says. Number one is at half power, shunting energy from it to the shields. Cassius gestures to the gash on the gold girl's stomach. Cauterize that or she'll bleed out. He rushes through the survivors of the crew to the bridge. The gold girl is losing too much blood. Her skin is pale under the black oil and her chest rises and falls with shallow rapidity. I lift her arm to get her to the infirmary, but she's too weak. The stims have overloaded her system. Her legs go out, so I loop my arm behind her knees and my other around her neck and carry her through the narrow halls. The fierce face she wore when I first found her is gone. She's quiet and still, her eyes watching me, so distant from the chaos around us. I lay her down on the medical bed as the Arche's guns fire. The infirmary is small and understocked. Syringes tremble in their cases as we take another hit. Those screaming faces of the low colours, the whales still chase me. They'll all die. The girl watches as I cut open her soiled shirt with medical shears. Two minor lacerations rend her skin above her breasts. My main concern is the axe wound. It's a deep and angry gouge 6 inches long in her lower left abdomen. What was she thinking going back? What could have been so important? I clean the wound with an anti-bac spray and use the hospital-grade medical scanner to inspect her organs for damage. Her liver is lacerated. She'll need a real surgeon, and soon. All I can do here is cauterize the capillaries and load her with blood sim. Flesh sizzles under the laser. She groans in pain. Once it's sealed, I apply a layer of res flesh and strap on a compression pack. The ship shudders. Who are you? I ask the girl. What's your name? She does not answer as her eyes drift closed. S1392, she whispers. Help at S1392. Her words trail away as she falls unconscious. S1392 is the asteroid she was heading toward. But what did she mean by help? I examine her as if her face will hold the answers. The lashes of her eyes are no longer than I might have expected, but even with the smear of blood and oil, I can see the stringy muscles of a fighter and a testament of old scars upon her skin. Too many for her young age. I trace my fingers over the 6 parallel scars that rake her lower back. Accompanying those scars are 2 old knife wounds near her heart, a terrible burn on her left arm, and the remnants of an old wound on the left side of her head that claimed the top corner of her ear. I thought of her as a girl when I found her in that cage, but she's not a girl. She's a predator in young skin. Who else would go back into that nightmare ship? Why did you have to take my razor? Did she leave something behind? I search her clothes, her body. There's nothing hidden, no false teeth. But I have a suspicion. I run my hand over her face. The cheekbones are bold and high and covered like the rest of her face with oil. I scrape my nails along her closed eyelids. The false lashes there are well made and applied with some sort of resin. My fingers drift to her right cheek. Dread twists my belly as I feel the skin there give. I stand up and away. I know what she is. I suspected when she stole my razor, and then when her voice broke from the accent of the Palatine. Was she affecting that one? Was it a guise? I pick the corner of the odd patch of skin on her face till a thin layer of res flesh, the same sort Cassius uses to disguise himself, pulls away from the cheek, revealing what lies beneath. Along her right cheekbone, slashing through the black oil at a cruel angle, is the pale mark of a peerless scarred.